As Glenn said, my mother is a retired director of religious education, which means that as a child growing up in the congregation in which she served, I got to see what was happening behind the curtain. And I swore that no matter what, I would never, ever, ever become a religious professional. Least of all, a director of education. There seemed to be no end to the amount of work that she did. Some of this might seem familiar to some of you. Teacher recruitment, committee meetings, lesson plan copying, writing, creating, adapting, supply closet cleaning, meetings with parents, with the board, with children, with their siblings, budget worries, locking and unlocking the doors, making and cleaning up coffee, finding last-minute substitutes between when we had breakfast on Sunday morning and when we left the house on Sunday morning, putting away tables and chairs, creating worship that works for all ages, buying Kleenex, and sleeping on church floors for overnights. Now, it seemed to me as a child that we either never left the church building or were on our way to the church building. But rarely did I mind. Yet still, I could not for the life of me understand why my mother enjoyed her job as much as she did. But she did. She loved it. And I think it is her love of the job and our faith that rubbed off on me. You see, I have been a Unitarian Universalist for almost 50 years. I am a member of that special first generation of Unitarian Universalists, those who were raised in the post-consolidated Unitarian Universalist Association, after the Universalist Church of America and the American Unitarian Association combined their congregations and resources to create what we now know as the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations. And footnote, that was 1961. Unlike what happened in the sanctuaries of our congregations, what was taught in the religious education programs in that post-consolidated faith was a new religion, not a compromise between the Universalists and the Unitarians, but a true merged and consolidated faith. Which means that I have been practicing this new faith, this Unitarian Universalism, my entire life. And I can say only one thing with absolute certainty about it. Our faith is not an easy one to practice. It demands of us that we be in constant awareness and dialogue with the world, with ourselves, and with each other. Unitarian Universalism requires religious engagement, not just when it is convenient or easy, but in every moment of our lives. When I say it requires religious engagement, I don't mean that we must kneel and bow and pray once or twice or four times or more times. Nor do I mean that we must pray to a particular deity or ideal, or that we even believe together in a deity. What I mean when I say religious engagement is that we think about something beyond our individual selves. The kids that I have worked with over the years will tell you that I often talk about magic and science and religion interchangeably, because from where I have been and what I have experienced, what we call magic and what we call religion and what we call science is sometimes determined by our knowledge. And sometimes it is that felt lived experience that we cannot explain yet through science. Now, don't get me wrong, I am definitely a science believer as much as I am a religious person. And I think my favorite piece of science is string theory. That idea, right? That idea that everything is connected one to another. If we frame that same theory in religious language, in Unitarian Universalist religious language, we might call it the interdependent web of all existence, science and religion. Either way, I trust that it exists, and I hope you have experienced it from time to time. For me, the experience sometimes goes like this. My co-moderator of the UUA, Alandria Williams, and I have a unique or hopefully not unique connection. There are days that despite living on opposite sides of the country and in different time zones, despite not being in conversation every moment to moment, though we often wish we could, there are moments where we feel that tug to talk with one another. It's not motivated by something that has come up through an email chain or an announcement or on Facebook. It's just a sense that we both hold. My science friends tell me that that could be string theory. My religious friends tell me that could be God tying us together. My spiritual but not religious friends tell me that it is just what happens when hearts and lives intertwine. Regardless of what we call it, I know it is a true felt sense. And when I talk about religious engagement and Unitarian Universalism, what I mean is keeping ourselves open to that possibility. That we don't presume to know more than another faith tradition, but that we are open to exploring with one another what our understandings of faith might be. And through that exploration, we open ourselves to new experiences and new sources of information. One of my biggest sources for making sense out of the world and finding inspiration is science fiction. I'm just saying. About 20 years ago, a little longer than that, writer Josh Wheaton created a television show. You might have heard of it, Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Amen.
Right? I'm saying. And if you know Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you might also know its spinoff show, Angel. There is a scene in Angel where the world has almost totally fallen apart, as usual. The demons are taking over, as usual. Our heroes are not quite sure what was going to happen next, as usual. And they were losing hope and having a hard time figuring out how to engage in the world around them. After having been missing for a few months, our main character, conveniently named Angel, returns, sharing how he'd been trapped under the sea by none other than his son, and that being trapped had given him some time to think and gain some perspective. And this is what he shares to the gathered group. Nothing in the world is the way it ought to be. It's harsh and cruel. And yet it doesn't matter where we come from, what we've done or suffered, or even if we make a difference. We live as though the world was what it should be in order to show it what it can be. We live as though the world was what it should be in order to show it what it can be. That, to do that, is to live religiously as a Unitarian Universalist. To be the one to name that despite the world feeling like we're losing, feeling like our perspective and our values are not the strongest perspective in the world, and yet to be able to turn around and not give up hope. To stay strong and continue to live into the world in ways that we believe it can be. That is to live religiously engaged in the context of Unitarian Universalism. And not surprisingly, it is also a faithful way to lead. I've had some incredible experiences as a Unitarian Universalist, all of which have brought me to have the resume that Glenn so beautifully shared with you. And that's the short version. Yeah. As a youngin, I had access to some things that perhaps other children and youth might not have had because they didn't spend all, and I mean all, of their childhood in the church. And because I grew up and lived in the church, I felt a little bit of a sense of home and familiarity and empowerment. And so it was that I took time as a youngster to water the tree in the sanctuary, a beautiful Christmas tree such as you have here, because I thought, as my Sunday school class had taught me, that nature needs water, and it was a tree that was stuck inside, not able to get its own water. What I didn't know, though, was that trees aren't always alive, and that some of them are made out of plastic. So that was a good lesson to learn. plastic Christmas trees do not necessarily need to be watered. And in the doing so, you might inadvertently water the sanctuary floor. So through that moment, I made a connection to an adult in my congregation, a very important adult. He was the sexton of the church, and he taught me not only the importance of not watering the plastic tree, but the importance of cleaning up after ourselves and the inner workings of the building of the church. And through that teaching, he taught me that the room setup is a form of leadership, that where the coffee table goes and how the chairs are arranged, whether or not there are tables set up before the meeting or when people arrive, that all of this sets the tone for a meeting. He taught me that sometimes the person in the front of the room is not the true leader of the group at all, but rather the leader is the first person who follows the speaker. And I can say, as someone who has spent the better part of my life in the front of the room thinking that I'm the leader, it was a little humbling to realize that perhaps I'm not. We spend all of our time to either be the person in the front of the room or to honor the person standing in the front of the room. And it's good to do that. Now, don't get me wrong, and I don't want Maria Christina coming back and learning that I said, don't trust or don't follow her up here. So just clarifying that. But in actuality, that idea, right, that idea of the second person as the leader, let's consider that. The first person has an idea, and we tend to say that that's the leader, the idea maker. But that second person who recognizes the idea and follows it, they're really the leader. How many times have you been in a situation where somebody throws out an idea and you think it's a good one, but you still wait to see if anybody else goes for it? Who are you really following? The idea thrower? Or the first follower? I spend most of my time these days in front of rather than among members of our congregations, and I appreciate that despite this and my being one of the elected leaders of our faith, I'm not the leader, that someone out there is. And, you know, be careful with this. I'm going to invite you to turn to your left. Go ahead, turn to your left and turn to your right. And maybe if you've got a mirror, check the mirror. Because the leader might be you. Sometimes that's how you end up in this spot up here as well. You were the one to follow the idea maker from time to time, maybe multiple times. And then the next thing you know, you've been invited to be the speaker. And from there, maybe you're invited to sit on a board or a committee. And from there, you become the board chair. And from there, you're doing something else, and who knows what. It might have started just simply by being in a religious education classroom or in a conversation at coffee hour. And the next thing you know, people are following you. And while not all leadership development happens at church, church can be a great place for leadership to be developed. I know it has been for me, and I suspect, and I hope, that for many of you, it has been as well. For me, it all began in fifth grade. I was in one of those infamous classes of students who regularly escaped the classroom and ran amok in the building. I'm sure you have no such classes here. Our class was very fond of hiding in, of all places, the boiler room. And the director of religious education, who is not my mom, she started the year after. Not my fault, I swear. The director of religious education decided that maybe our class, the troublesome class, should be split up. So she took a couple of us quieter kids, and believe it or not, I was one of the quieter ones back then. She decided that we would be classroom aides. So I was moved from the fifth grade class to the first grade class to be the teacher's assistant. In theory, I was there to help with playground, with Play-Doh and snacks and whatever other errands needed to be run. But Louise Rivers, who had been a longtime professional teacher and was the primary teacher of the classroom, took one glance at me and said, hands on hips, if you're going to be in my classroom, you're going to be a full teacher. And so she taught me how to teach. I half blame my mom, and I half blame Louise for where I am today. But what Louise taught me in that moment, beyond how to teach, what she taught me is that to be a leader takes some skill and training. It doesn't always come naturally. Oftentimes, it's easy to look up at the leader and think, I could never do that. They're so poised, so calm, so collected. What you might not notice, and thankfully you've got a solid pulpit here for me to hide it, is the knees are knocking, the legs are shaking, and the stomach is quivering. Louise taught me that to be a leader is to say yes to the opportunity and to learn into the role. She also taught me, and I've used it as I've gotten older, to always be on the lookout for potential in everyone. Whether it's the troublemaker from the fifth grade class, or the quiet person sitting in the back corner, or the person up front raising their hand regularly. Being a leader means accepting and seeking out opportunities to lead, and also inviting others into leadership, into community. As I have aged, I've faced more and more opportunities to lead and to teach. I stayed with that first grade class, moving up along with them until I reached high school. Once I was in high school, I was invited to be a youth leader of our congregation's youth group. And through that, I became a youth advisor and a youth advisor training because somehow in my 4 years of high school, I had magically helped the youth group grow from 5 to 20 youth. So when I was a senior in high school, the director of religious education at the neighboring Unitarian Universalist Church invited me to lead a workshop on youth advising and youth group growth at a conference she was hosting. And shortly after that, I was a young adult and being paid to be a youth advisor, which is how I found myself driving from Massachusetts to Spokane, Washington, to my first General Assembly, sponsoring two youth from the group I was advising. And it was at that first General Assembly, believe it or not, almost 25 years ago, while in Spokane, I reconnected with an old colleague who had encouraged me to apply for the UUA job he was leaving, which I did, and soon after found myself employed by our faith headquarters in Boston, where I did most of what was in my bio there. Opportunities in leadership are always possible, and they're all around us. And they sometimes come in a very, very strange place. David Glasgow, who is a UU musician and religious professional, shared this story on Facebook over the summer. He had witnessed an accident on the highway. He stopped and got out of his car in the pouring rain to stop and redirect traffic. And he shared that his dad had set an example decades ago of how important it is to keep a level head when one witnesses an accident, and that most human beings will obey a dripping weirdo standing in the middle of the road directing them onto an exit ramp, even when they'd rather continue ahead, and even if that person is not wearing a police uniform. Sometimes leadership is just about keeping a calm head. It's about taking time to slow things down and to make sure to care for our souls. Sometimes it is just doing what the rabbi in this morning's story did, making time to pray twice as much, twice as often. I found for me that slowing down has made a huge difference in my leadership capabilities and style. In the recent years, my leadership opportunities have included being the board chair of Star King School for the Ministry during a tumultuous time, and currently as board chair of the UUA, at also what we might someday call a rough moment in our history. The biggest learning that I've had time and again is the importance to slow down for myself, for my boards, and for our faith. To take the time to do the heart work, not just the hard work. And to not let the agenda drive the conversation. And it is hard. It is hard because we as a faith are a task-driven community. I mean, Unitarian Universalism in general. We like to get things done. It stems back from our Puritan ancestors who believed that all of life should be hard work and no fun, so no laughing. And even though we're all the way out here on the West Coast and theoretically far, far away from both New England and the Puritan time period, that culture still drives us and undergirds most of what we do. So that idea of slowing down, of praying twice as much, whatever prayer means to you. Now, it might be meditating. It might be saying words of hope and petition and gratitude. It might be just slowing your breath. It might be singing or moving your body. It doesn't really matter exactly what it is, as long as it slows down the speed of your life. Doing so can allow us to climb into the metaphoric balcony, which is another important aspect of leadership. I mean, I like the jazz in the middle. It was like perfectly timed, James. Taking the balcony view allows us to listen to the music and also to take in the whole picture, to get out of the weeds, as they say. If you've ever gardened, you know it is easy to notice every flaw, every weed, while you're in the garden. But when you're up on the balcony or the porch, you can take in the beauty of the garden without seeing each of those small details. Being in leadership is about holding true to the whole garden, the imagination of what it can be, and the reality of what it is. Knowing the importance of when to weed, and when to prune, and when to feed and water, and when to let growth happen. Remembering that it doesn't need to happen all at once, nor does it need to be done by you alone. Leadership is as much about holding the big picture as it is delegating and sharing responsibility. UU minister in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the Reverend Adam Dyer, reminds us that 95% of leadership is knowing how and when to let others be in charge because they are better equipped and more capable. One of my greatest learnings in leadership has been to get out of my own way. Whether that's to reduce my own anxiety or to invite someone else in to be a part of the leading or to share the workload, it's important to me to remember, and sometimes challenging to practice. I have found that it requires of me to give up a little, and sometimes more than a little, of my ego, and often my comfort. For me, sometimes it means being willing to have things done differently than I would have done them, and perhaps being okay with that. It is essential in spaces where we want to embrace and share leadership. And this is particularly important at this time in our faith, as we consider ways we've led and been led, as we learn from our past and plan for our future, as we make space for all the people who want to be a part of our faith communities, and we make space at the table for those who have been or are on the margins and historically have not been invited or had access to leadership roles. Our faith asks us that we transform our leadership models. One of the things co-moderator Alandria and I said at General Assembly is that for us, we have struggled with the question, what does it mean to have a leader-full movement, a leader-full organization, and leader-full congregations? And specifically, what can collaborative leadership look like in these contexts? For a long time, our movement's understanding of leadership has been a top-down one for all of our talk of not being hierarchical. But as a lifelong Unitarian Universalist, Alandria and I believe that collaborative leadership is the most authentically UU model we can use and create. When we make space for different leadership models, we make space for different leaders. May we all strive to move through the world, taking a breath, and making space for different models and different leaders. And may we each live as though the world is what it should be in order to show it what it can be. May it be so, and may we be the ones to make it so.